Before we go back into the practice and then move on to the next section of the text, I think there was one or two outstanding questions from the last session.
I had a question about it was from Amuda. The text, the biting and dissolving of the winds into the central channel, but it was a speaker of methods of penetrating the little points of subtle viral body. Is it Kundalini?
Kundalini is a term that I think comes from Hinduism. And Kundalini is a term used to describe certain subtle energy flow in the body. Normally in Buddhist tantra, you don't hear the word Kundalini. So what the parallel is, I'm not sure, because I've not studied Hinduism. So I don't know exactly what that is referring to. But it is a type of energy that is tried to gain access to, I think, within the Hindu system. But more than that, I don't know.
I remember I once saw YouTube meditation when there was Kundalini, and when people in the beginning they just lost their mind, but then they started to move like saints, and then they found peace and they sat and
Any sort of subtle energy work like that is very powerful. I mean, you have very simple energy work like Reiki and so forth, but at this level, whether it's Kundalini or doing Tummo or one of the Buddhist practices, they're very powerful practices, very powerful energy. And like for the Tummo, you get a lot of bliss and inner heat. But they're not a game. It's not something to play with. And that's often what people do. They just play with it. They hear, oh, Kundalini, I can have some blissful experience. I'll do that. And actually that reminds me of an actual example is when I was teaching in Dharamsala, a course, I was mentioning about this point and how these sorts of practices are normally only taught to people when they're ready and they can do them in a good way and they're not something to play with because they can damage you psychologically. Because yesterday I said that the subtle energies in the mind are like a rider and a horse. So if you're manipulating subtle energies not in a controlled way, you're manipulating the subtle mind in an uncontrolled way and the results can be disastrous. And I was explaining this in the course, and then after the session, one person came out to me and said, yes, this happened to my friend, that in Dharamsala there's a lot of these Kundalini workshops. In fact, there was advertised a Kundalini awakening workshop, 5-day workshop. And so he said that his friend went to it, and he said that during those 5 days they were pushing people to have this little experience of the Kundalini awakening. And his friend managed to have this experience. But then he said what happened as a result of that, he became completely delusional. He thought he was God. Really, he was completely delusional, so much so that his parents had to fly out to India to get him and take him home because he was completely gone psychotic. So these are not practices to play with, no matter how tempting they seem to be and how much they promise some sort of bliss experience. They're very powerful experiences, and if not done in a good way, they can completely psychologically damage the mind, and years later you're still trying to recover that damage. I mean, it's not something to play with. Mine. Well, not types, levels.
And I wonder how this perspective corresponds with the 5 aggregates. Because I remember here Buddha said that you are nothing else but 5 aggregates. So how do they fit together? It's completely different.
Yeah. I mean, the 5 aggregates are the basis of the person. It just means the five aggregates really just means the body and the mind.
Yeah, but just as I understand from that, there is nothing else, just five aggregates. What subtle energies and subtle body we're talking about?
Ah, because we're not. That's exactly the thing, is that at the sutra level, which is where we see the five aggregates presentation, there's no mention of subtle mind or very subtle mind anywhere in the texts. So in these presentations, you'll never see any presentation about clear light, mind, primordial mind, and so forth. It doesn't exist. So in the five aggregates presentation, there's no correlation at all for very subtle mind, because it's not part of the system. If you want to use that analogy, we're not even in kindergarten yet. So we shouldn't think that all Theravada or the sutra stuff, that's for babies. You know, I'm more advanced. Tantra is mine. That's crazy thinking.
I don't think like that.
No, I know, but it's not somehow like these lower levels here are somehow inferior. They're the basis. And so we need to work at whatever level we are at. And that is the most effective thing for us. So to go back to your question, the five aggregates is a presentation within this level. So within that, there's no reference to any subtle levels of mind. So the five aggregates basically are the body and mind. And so the mind that's mentioned in the five aggregates is the coarse mind. Because at this level of practice, that's the only mind that really exists. That's all. Okay, let's go back and do another meditation. So we're back to the shamatha practice, focusing on the nostrils. So one session, 24 minutes, okay? And then we'll move on in the text. We begin, as always, by preparing the body, setting it into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. and settling the mind into a state of ease and relaxation. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now narrowing the focus, focusing on the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. Focusing with bare attention, not visualizing, not imagining. Observing the subtle sensations of the breath directly. Relaxing and releasing any distractions on the out-breath, sharpening the focus on the in-breath. So let's continue to practice in silence. So let's go back into the text. So in the middle of page 3, so we've just finished a very short explanation of the tantra level of Mahamudra practice. And so now the majority of this text here, of course, is going to look at the sutra level of Mahamudra practice, because it's the sutra level of Mahamudra practice that is the basis for tantra level. So let's have a look now at the sutra level of Mahamudra practice. And here in the middle of page 3 it says, Sutra Mahamudra refers to the ways of meditating on emptiness, in Sanskrit, shunyata, as directly indicated in the extensive, middling and brief Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So it's the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, and there are quite a number of them, is where the Buddha taught this idea of emptiness. Of course, the most famous of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras is the Heart Sutra. Heart, the essence of the Perfection of Wisdom teaching. So many of the Mahayana Buddhist traditions have the Heart Sutra as an integral part of their daily practice and often recited on a daily basis. And then there's a quote here. It says, as said by the Supreme Arya Nagarjuna, there is no path to liberation other than this. When the Buddha taught, he taught according to people's capacities, and he taught a number of different ideas about what is the false view of reality at various levels. And because of these various different teachings that he gave, then in ancient India, different philosophical schools evolved according to those different teachings. And so now we can talk about four philosophical schools within Buddhism. And the first two schools, called Vaibhashika Sautrantika, are based on the Four Noble Truths teachings and the idea that the fundamental ignorance we're suffering from is this grasping onto this autonomous self. Whereas the other two philosophical schools, the Chittamatra or mind only, and then the Majjhimika or middle way school, these schools are based on the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, the ones mentioned here. So in both of those schools, they talk about this idea of emptiness, although they have a slightly different interpretation of what this word emptiness means. And the Majjhimika philosophical system really was founded by this great Indian master here, Nagarjuna. He lived around the 2nd century. So he wrote a classic text called Mula Majjhimika Karika, the Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way. And it's on the basis of this that really the Majjhimika philosophical system developed. So here we are referring to Nagarjuna or Nagarjuna, who's the founder of this Majjhimika philosophical system, which is the one that we are following here in this text in terms of how describing this idea of emptiness. So he says, there is no path to liberation other than this. Meaning if we want to be liberated from samsara, we have to come to realize this emptiness. As we briefly saw in the Three Vehicles chart, when we talk about the Theravada systems, the Theravada vehicle, and they have as their goal nirvana, to liberate ourselves from samsara, then there, when they talk about what is the antidote, what is the wisdom, then we saw in those three marks of existence, the wisdom is this wisdom of no self. So in fact, all the lower philosophical systems, those two and even the Chittamatra system, they all accept that to achieve nirvana, we need to just realize this no self, that that's enough. Whereas what Nagarjuna is saying here, because liberation also means nirvana, is that the only way to get to nirvana is by realizing this emptiness. So that's what he's saying here. So then he says, here I shall give instructions on Mahamudra in accordance with his thought. That means in accordance with the Nagarjuna's thought, in accordance with his understanding of emptiness, of shunyata, that the Buddha taught in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So there are different interpretations of what this emptiness means from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. One interpretation is within the Chittamatra philosophical system, the mind only. And even within the Majjhimika philosophical system, there are a few different ideas or about what emptiness really means. And we are following here Nagarjuna's understanding and describing ways to introduce the nature of the mind. So, of course, the nature of the mind is emptiness. Like all phenomena, the nature of all phenomena is emptiness. In accordance with the instructions of the lineage masters. So the lineage masters are the masters following from Nagarjuna who expanded or have the same understanding of emptiness as Nagarjuna. So we're following these. And one of the great Indian lineage masters that is often studied when we study emptiness is called, he's called Chandrakirti from about the 6th century. So he's very instrumental. Also Shantideva from the 8th century. And then of course here in this Guluk Mahamudra lineage that we're following, then of course the great Tibetan master is Tsongkhapa. So in fact, in this presentation later, when we come to the Vipassana part of the practice here, we'll see a very classic presentation of emptiness and how to come to cultivate that wisdom based on Tsongkhapa's profound method of establishing emptiness. Of course, in accordance with Nagarjuna's thought, his understanding. And then it says here, and we've already covered this when we looked at the title, why is that which is taught here called Mahamudra? So why is this wisdom of emptiness called Mahamudra? And again, quoting this sutra, the nature of all phenomena is a seal in terms of stamp. In that way, since emptiness is the nature of all phenomena, it is a seal, or in Sanskrit, mudra. And since when it is realized, one is liberated from all degenerations, it is great or supreme, maha in Sanskrit. So therefore, here emptiness is, the word Mahamudra is referring to this wisdom of emptiness because it's the great seal, because everything is stamped by emptiness as its ultimate nature. And when we realize emptiness, we will achieve the great goal of liberation. And then at the bottom of page 3, before I go into that, is there anything, any questions of anything I've just talked about now? I think it's fairly straightforward. Okay. Then if we look at the last paragraph here, it says there are many lineages of practice. So, of course, we're talking about Mahamudra practice, each one having their own unique name. And now he's quoting a number of different traditions here. Many of them, of course, are coming within the Kagyu tradition. So remember, the Mahamudra instructions came through Tolopa Naropa, Indian masters, into Tibet, Marpa, Milarepa, down to Gampopa. And Gampopa, who synthesized these Mahamudra instructions together with Atisha's Lam Rim instructions, and he founded the Kagyu school, Gampopa. And then a number of his disciples then established variations of those Mahamudra teachings, which formed the various different Kagyu schools. And we see that mentioned here. The first way of system of packaging Mahamudra is called the co-emergent union. And this is from the Karma Kagyu. And the Karma Kagyu was founded by one of Kampopa's main students called Dusum Kempa, who is now understood to be the first Karmapa. So Karma Kagyu, the head of the Karma Kagyu, of course, is the Karmapa. And I think we're up to number 16 or 17 now, the 17th Karmapa. So the Karmapa is head of the Karmakagyu school, and the way that they present Mahamudra practice is they package it as what's called this co-emergent union. And then we see some other ways of packaging Mahamudra. Amulet box is the Shangpa Kagyu. It's another sub-school in the Kagyu system. The five parts, Drikung Kagyu, another sub-school. Six cycles of equal taste, the Drupka Kagyu. Also, it's quite one of the main Kagyu schools still in existence today. And then we have the four syllables, which is coming from Maitripa. Maitripa was sort of contemporary with Naropa, so he's an Indian Mahasiddha. And in fact, he also was sort of instrumental in bringing, or through his lineage, instructions into Tibet as well. And then we have another one called the Pacifier. I think that system of practice doesn't really exist anymore. That's my understanding. From Padampa Sanghi, again, another great Indian Mahasiddha. And I think Padampa Sanghi was a student of Maitripa. Then we have Chir, quite well known within Tibetan Buddhism. And that was developed by Machik Labdron. She's a very famous Tibetan yogini. And she was a student of Padampa Sanghi, and she developed this Chir practice, which is quite widely practiced in many of the Tibetan traditions, particularly the Nyingma and Kagyu schools. There are many people who follow the Chir practice. And the Chir means cutting, means to cut. And it's really to cut off this self-grasping. And they do it in a very dramatic way. Often this Chir practice, practitioners go into very scary places. You know, one classic example is to go into a cemetery at night time to practice, and then to see that this grasping coming up, and then to cut it through their practice. So it's quite a well-known, and they do a lot of using the drums and so forth. So they use that as well in their practice. And then we have Dzogchen here, the great perfection, which is the practice, equivalent practice to Mahamudra within the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism. And then instructions on the Majjhimika view, which within the Gelug, and so forth. So there are many different systems of practice here, and they all have their own name. But then if we look over the page, the Panchen Lama says, however, when investigated by a yogi learned in definitive meaning scriptures, skilled in logical reasoning, and experienced in meditation, they all come down to the same intended meaning. So even though they're packaged quite differently and on the surface level they seem very different practices, if you go down to the core, to the essence, they all come down to the same point, this point of realizing emptiness. Particularly with respect to the mind, realizing the emptiness of the mind, the nature of the mind. So then if we continue on, he says, this being the case, from among the two systems within Sutra Mahamudra, so there are two approaches within Sutra Mahamudra, and that is, the first is seeking to meditate after having gained the correct view, and that is after having gained the correct view of emptiness, and then seeking the correct view after having meditated, here I shall explain in accordance with the latter system. So what that means is we have two approaches to practice. First, we can either develop the correct view and then meditate, or we can meditate and then develop and then get the correct view out of that. And he comments on that in his auto-commentary following. He says, now it is true that there are the two different systems. However, the system of seeking the correct view after having meditated is in accordance with that said by the protector Shantideva. So again, Shantideva, great Indian master from the 8th century who's part of this lineage. He says, Vipassana endowed with shamatha completely destroys the afflictions. Knowing this, first seek shamatha, Meaning, first we meditate and achieve shamatha, then we enter into vipassana practice. And then he's also quoting a sutra. He says, also that said in the Pile of Jewels Sutra, through abiding in ethics, concentration is attained. Having attained concentration, cultivate wisdom. So that is the order. So that's the order that we are going to look at this Sutra Mahamudra practice, because in Sutra Mahamudra, we need to practice both Vipassana and Shamatha. And we can do them in either order, but the order we're following here is the same order mentioned by Shantideva and in the Sutra. That is Shamatha, then Vipassana. So that's what we're going to be doing here. So we're first going to look at the shamatha practice. So remember, shamatha is the concentration practice. Shamatha is a Sanskrit word, of course, and we can break that word shamatha into two parts. Shama means non-discursive or calm. Ta means to remain or abide. So often shamatha is translated as calm abiding in English. So often you'll see in text the calm abiding practice. It's a particular level of samadhi. So samadhi is a Sanskrit word which means concentration. There are many levels of samadhi that we can develop in the spiritual path. And the minimum level of samadhi that is required is shamatha. So just to briefly mention some of these levels of samadhi. We can often talk about sort of nine levels of samadhi. And the minimum level of samadhi that is required to have a basis for vipassana practice is shamatha. And then above that, we have what four levels called the dhyanas. Dhyana often is translated also in English as concentration. And then above these four levels of dhyana, we have four levels, what's called samapatti, four levels. And that's often translated into English as absorption. So these are higher and higher levels of concentration. The minimum level we need as a basis for vipassana practice is shamatha. When you go and look into Theravada traditions, and they talk about concentration practice, normally you don't really see this word shamatha. Normally in the Theravada traditions, when they talk about concentration practice, they're talking about developing these dhyanas. So they often talk about dhyana practice. Whereas in the Mahayana traditions, as looking here in the Mahamudra practice, then concentration practice, normally we're focusing on shamatha, that level of concentration. These samapattis, absorptions, are higher levels of concentration, but as the name suggests, we're completely absorbed. And when we absorb to this level, it's too absorbed to actually then enter into vipassana practice. So they're useful for being very calm and peaceful and so forth, but as a basis for vipassana practice, they're too absorbed. So any of these five levels are good as a basis for vipassana practice.
But here, we're in this, we're just simply talking about developing this level of concentration called shamatha. Any questions about that? Yeah. Samadhi is a very general term, meaning concentration. So samadhi, all of these are samadhi. Samadhi just means concentration. So we have here 9 levels of samadhi. One of those is shamatha. I mean, we could say we're doing samadhi practice. That's a very general term, but that's not really indicating which level are we striving to achieve. So that's the very general term, and these are specific levels of samadhi.
So samadhi is not a goal to be reached?
No. And of course, the Buddha, when he, Prince Siddhartha, when he left the palace, you know, looking for the answer, he had a number of teachers originally, and at that time, those spiritual traditions felt that this, if you go this way, you'll pop out of samsara. That if you keep developing higher levels of samadhi, you will be liberated. So they put effort into doing this. But this is just concentration. And of course, the higher the concentration we develop, the more that will subdue the mental afflictions. But it doesn't eliminate them. It just keeps the lid on them. So when you develop these higher levels of samadhi and you come out of meditation, it seems like the mental afflictions have gone. We've got rid of them. But eventually, when the samadhi sort of degenerates a bit, they come back. So all that's happening is we're keeping the lid on them. And so that's what Prince Siddhartha found. He developed these high levels, got right up to the top here, and found he wasn't liberated from suffering. So he understood that this wasn't enough to be liberated. You needed the Vipassana practice, the insight practice, that samadhi was not enough to get out of. Because to overcome suffering, we need to eliminate the cause, mental afflictions and ignorance. To eliminate that, we need the antidote to that, which is wisdom. And there's no wisdom here, there's just concentration.
Does it mean that shamatha is the lowest level of concentration,
and for example, dhyana is a deeper level of concentration? Yeah, dhyana is a deeper level of concentration, that's right. But of course, and so the fourth level of that is more stable, more clear. But of course, to develop that takes a lot of effort. Yeah. So of course, if we can develop all the jhanas as well, after, on top of shamatha, very good. But of course, not so easy. But the minimum, what we're saying here is that the minimum level of concentration we need to be able to gain a direct realization of emptiness is shamatha. With anything less than that, our mind is not stable and clear enough to directly penetrate reality. If we have something a little bit less, yes, we can have a very profound experience of emptiness, but we won't be able to get to direct realization because the mind is not stable and clear enough. That is stable and clear enough to directly realize emptiness. And of course, these for sure, absolutely.
Okay. Then if we move into the text, it says here, this being the case, what is the method for initially cultivating shamatha? So here in the outline, we see that there are two parts, preparation and actual practice. So here in preparation, what we can see actually is preparation means how can we prepare ourselves in terms of having conducive conditions to begin practice? That's first part of preparation. The second part of preparation then is when we actually start the meditation, how can we prepare ourselves well at the beginning of the meditation? So preparation covers both of that. How can we prepare ourselves outside of meditation to be in a good state to actually meditate, and then how do we prepare ourselves in the beginning of each meditation session. So let's look at both of those preparations. And the first one starts with a quote from Maitreya, from a text called Ornament for the Mahayana Sutras, and he says, "The place where the intelligent practice is a place with easy access, a safe place, a place with good ground and good friends and the requisites for yogic practice." It is explained that, and then the Panchen Lama is now explaining that verse a little bit. He says, "It is explained that while remaining in such a place, it is necessary to rely on the prerequisites for shamatha by abiding in pure ethics, having few desires, being content, and so forth. And it is definitely necessary to do the six preparatory practices." So the six preparatory practices are the things that we do at the beginning of each meditation. But before that, he's saying, how can we prepare ourselves well for shamatha practice in general? And here he talks about the prerequisites. So we can talk about six prerequisites for shamatha practice. So these six prerequisites, the first one is referring to having suitable outer conditions, and then the last five are suitable inner conditions, conducive inner conditions. And the outer conditions are what is described in the verse from Maitreya here. So the first prerequisite is to have a supportive environment. Now, here, when he's talking about preparing for shamatha, we're really talking, of course, historically, and we're talking about someone who wants to go and do a long-term retreat to achieve shamatha. What does that person need as a basis? So what sort of outer environment would you need if you wanted to go off and do long-term retreat to achieve shamatha? And so that's what's mentioned here in the verse. And here, supportive environment, there are five things here mentioned. The first, it says, the place where the intelligent practice is a place with easy access. Easy access means easy access to the basic necessities such as food and water and so forth. Because, particularly historically, if you didn't have easy access to food and water, it would be difficult. You know, sometimes people like to go and meditate up in a cave in the mountains or something, but then the nearest water is like 2 kilometres down the hill, and you have to go down there and get it every day and back. That's not so conducive. So that's what this means here, the basic necessities, to have them easily available. And then it says here, a safe place. And sometimes in the texts here, when they comment on this, remember we're talking historically, it sometimes says a safe place means a place that doesn't have lions and tigers and things like that. So imagine if you're meditating in the jungle somewhere and then some big tiger or a lion came and sort of attacked you, that wouldn't be very good. So safe place just means safe. And also, of course, we extend that to, you know, if we're trying to meditate in the middle of a war zone, that's probably not going to be very conducive. Then the third point here is a place with good ground. Good ground here means a place that is healthy, you know, there's not full of disease and so forth. And then we have good friends.
So if we're doing, of course, some sort of longer-term shamatha practice, we need good friends in terms of we're probably going to need someone who's supplying us with food. We may need to also, if we have some difficulties in our practice, we may need to have some, and a good friend here can also mean like the Sangha, spiritual community. It may be useful to be able to contact someone if you have some questions about the practice that can help you to overcome any difficulties in your practice, things like that. So that's what good friends means here. So people that can support you materially or even with some advice and guidance.
And then the last point here is it says, and the requisites for yogic practice. So here when it talks about requisites for yogic practice, this refers to the fact of having a place that is quiet and not too many people around. So in terms of being quiet and not a lot of people around in the area. So that's what it means here by the requisites for yogic practice. So these are the five things mentioned as the supportive environment. So the supportive environment is the outer conditions that we're looking for. And then the other five of the six prerequisites are more inner conditions that we're trying to find. And some of those are mentioned in the commentary here, where he talks about abiding in pure ethics, having few desires, being content, and so forth. So the second and third is few desires and being content. And so this is relating to material things. And few desires is with respect to things that we don't have, and being content is with respect to the things we do have. So, of course, if we're in shamatha retreat and we're wanting, you know, nicer things and more stuff and that, then that's not very conducive to shamatha practice. So, therefore, to really let go of that craving for more and more material stuff and more material comfort, to be content with the basics, what the minimum that we need. And then the fourth one is then
few activities, meaning not to do too many different things. Of course, if you're doing too many different things in the retreat, then you're not focusing on the practice. So we need to simplify our life there. Of course, to have just do the minimum activities. Maybe we need to cook a little bit to provide meals for ourselves and so forth, but then not to do all these extra activities that take up our time and our energy in the retreat.
Okay. And then the fifth one here was the pure ethics.
So to have pure ethics. So as we've already seen, in all of the Buddhist traditions, the three core areas of practice are ethics, concentration, wisdom. So ethics is the basics. So again, if we're not really being ethical, then shamatha retreat is going to be very difficult because our mind will be very agitated. And if we're engaging in harmful behaviour, we may have problems coming our way and so forth. So pure ethics is the basis, is essential. And then the last sixth point
is to abandon compulsive thinking. You know, we all tend to obsess and compulsively think about certain things. And of course, if we have that type of mind and we're trying to practice shamatha, it's going to be a huge obstacle. So if we have any obsessive compulsive things, a thinking, and often it's in terms of the future, you know, what's may or may not happen. So we have a lot of hope and fear and expectation about the retreat and so forth. Then if we have that, then the shamatha practice is not going to work. So we need to let go of that, any sort of obsessive compulsive thinking, as much as possible, because it'll be an obstacle to the shamatha practice. So these last five points are more about inner conditions. So any questions about any of these six prerequisites? So remember, this is presented in the context, certainly historic context, of someone who's going off to do some long-term retreat to achieve shamatha. But I think we can also apply this, even if we're not going off to do long-term retreat, but we want to have we want to do meditation in our life, and we want to have our life heading in that sort of, in a more meaningful direction, then I think it would be good to try to have these conditions in our life to support us in the practice. For example, few activities is very important. You know, in our life, you know, we might want to meditate, but often people say, oh, I'm too busy to meditate. And that's probably true. Most of us are probably very busy in our life, you know. We fill up our life with lots of stuff. Some of that is essential. Some of the activities we fill up our life with is not really essential, and maybe some of them don't bring us any benefit at all. It's just to fill up time. So then, of course, to squeeze in meditation in that full thing is not going to work. So then we need to really look at all the things that we do and see which are essential, which are meaningful and helpful, and which are just wasting time. And if we look really closely, I think you'll find a lot of these things we can let go of, and then we'll have a more simple lifestyle, and we'll be able to devote time and energy to meditation and so forth. And of course, this also is very important in our life, few desires being content, because if we and unfortunately, in our modern society, there still is the general perception that money is a source of happiness. That, you know, if I get more money and have more stuff and more pleasure, I'm going to be more happy. So, of course, as we see, people working longer hours to earn a little bit more money to buy a bigger car, better house that we can't enjoy because we've got no time to enjoy them because we're working, paying for them. I mean, of course, if we have this thinking, then forget about shamatha practice. It's not going to happen. So if we can have few desires in terms of material wealth and be content with the basics, then that's going to be very helpful. In fact, I saw a study that someone did not so long ago regarding this point, where they mapped happiness versus wealth. And of course, initially, it went like this. Because if you have no money, then you're probably starving, you don't have a roof over your head. I mean, you're not going to be very happy if you don't have the basic necessities. But what they found was, when you got to a point of wealth that covered your basic necessities in life, after that point, more wealth didn't increase happiness, actually went down. That if you gained more wealth than you actually needed for the basics, you actually became less happy. Because then what happened was, of course, is that when we go this way, it's because we believe more wealth will bring more happiness. And so, of course, when it doesn't, then we get frustrated, and then, of course, happiness goes down. Okay. Any questions? Yeah. The which sutra? Yeah. Yeah.
For abiding in ethics, concentration is attained.
Yeah.
And so on.
Yeah.
But is it just a saying like that, true abiding in ethics? I mean, I understand it like if you abide, I mean, the abiding in ethics itself helps you to concentrate.
Correct. That's right.
Can you explain it shortly?
Because if you're not being ethical, and if you're deceiving and cheating people, you're probably going to have a very agitated mind, and then probably people are trying to cheat you, and so you're always having to be on guard and worry about this, and I have to say this to this person and do that. So it's going to be very agitating to our mind to have unethical behaviour. And then, of course, we're probably going to find a lot of unethical behaviour directed toward us, and we're going to have a lot of mental and physical suffering because of that. So if we're in this agitated state of mental and physical suffering, how are we going to develop concentration?
Yeah, this itself is not enough.
No, no, no. But of course, if we have an ethical lifestyle, then we feel good about ourselves and the mind is much more calm. And then on that basis, if we sit down to do shamatha practice, much more easily will we achieve that goal. So, yes, if you just abide in ethics, you're not going to suddenly have shamatha. But that basis will be a very good basis for now going into the shamatha practice. Yeah.
And when you say ethics from a mudra practice, how loose can we understand that ethics? For example, Berzin is quite liberal in interpreting ethics because he looks from a more theoretical and philosophical perspective. If you go into traditional writings, they are more detailed, and if you take them word by word, it's probably more kind of strict a little bit. And if you go to Geluk Monk ethics, it's 350 precepts, it's probably much more than that. So which ethics is needed here? What level of ethics? Is it important or not?
Of course it's important, and what we saw was that in the Mahamudra practice we have two levels, sutra and tantra. The ethics that we need to sustain in tantra is extremely high, extremely high. And that's necessary because of the nature of the perspective of the practice of tantra. For example, at the level of tantra practice, if we give up love, you know, the wish for someone to be happy, if we give that up for even one single sentient being, even one, that is considered a serious ethical downfall at the level of tantra. Because then we are completely contradicting the whole perspective of tantric practice. That's the level of ethics we need at tantra. Of course, sutra level of ethics to practice there is not, we don't have to have such a high level as with tantric practice. Now, of course, within sutra level, particularly when we're talking Mahamudra practice, which is Mahayana practice. So in Mahayana, the perspective or focus is not just our own liberation, but to help liberate everyone else. So there, the ethics that we need to sustain that is much more difficult than the ethics at the level of merely striving for our own liberation. So you'll find that every level you go up, to have a good basis to practice at that higher level, we need more pure ethics as we go up. So it depends at what level, what would be the minimum level of ethics to sustain that level of practice. So it varies according to the level. But of course, in general, even at the lowest level, avoiding harmful, non-virtuous behaviour, of course, is standard in any sort of ethics. And of course, from a Buddhist perspective, that is coming from the interdependent nature of reality. It's not really coming because someone's made a list and said, these are bad, this is good, don't do this, do this. Although we have those lists available in terms of the 10 non-virtues and so forth, but they are based on the idea of interdependent nature of reality, based on the idea of emptiness. It's not some just arbitrary list that someone thought, that's a nice list, that's what I think is ethical, so you should follow that. It's not really like that. So, you know, that's the measure, I think, of if we're looking in certain behaviour, whether it's ethical or not, is it in harmony with this the interconnected nature of reality or not? Of course, that may be not so easy for us to determine, but that's a way we can see or try to determine if some behaviour is ethical or not.
And about that last point, abandoning compulsive thinking.
Yeah.
I know when I see that, I start to be so disappointed about myself because, you know, I just think so much and, like, it doesn't seem that it can be, you know, abandoned because I say I can't control my thinking. Mm. And somehow I will ever able to control thoughts.
Yeah.
Or just becoming of thoughts.
Right. So what we're saying here is we're not saying stop thinking. That's impossible and not helpful.
Compulsive.
Compulsive means out of control. We're not in control. Our mind is in control. The mind is driving us. We're out of control. We're the slave of our mind. So that's what the type of thinking we need to get rid of. Of course we need thinking. Otherwise we can't do anything. We need thinking, but we need to be in the driver's seat. We need to think when we want, in a good way, directed towards a good thing. That thinking we need. What we don't need is compulsive thinking, where suddenly something comes up and it churns around and we are the slaves of that thinking.
You mean even then we behave or, like, I don't know, you mean those thoughts which turn into behavior? Or just, we're speaking now about controlling any types of thoughts. Because I can't turn off the radio.
Yeah, but again, the word control I don't like. Because when you say control, it has the idea we have to force it somehow. But that's not...
It's impossible to stop.
Exactly. So we should not try it, because trying to control in terms of trying to stop it is like throwing petrol on the fire. It's just going to get worse, because we're going to get more frustrated that we can't do it and more stuff's going to come up. So I don't like the word control, but rather... To abandon means to let go of, not to sort of squeeze it so it stops. That's never going to work. So what abandoning compulsive thinking here, one step or one thing we can do is to see how unproductive and harmful that type of thinking is. And then once we start to see that a certain line of thinking is very dysfunctional, that's the first step to starting to be able to let it go. On top of that, what is also very helpful here is a lot of our obsessive compulsive thinking is related to stuff out there that I want or stuff out there that I don't want. And we're obsessively compulsively thinking about what may or may not happen in the future with regard to that. So if we can, and this is going to come up in the preparation, the preliminaries, this afternoon or tomorrow, is if we can shift our focus from looking out there for happiness and suffering to shift it in here, I think you'll find a lot of this will just drop away. Because a lot of this is driven by our desire to find happiness out there and to avoid suffering out there. If we continue to have that focus, this will continue to thrive. And then we won't be able to to do anything. We won't be able to abandon or even reduce at all, because it's been caused through this wrong focus out there. So that's another thing that we can do to help reduce this compulsive thinking. And also, even though this is a prerequisite to shamatha, it doesn't mean we have to get rid of it before we start shamatha practice. Otherwise, we're never going to start shamatha practice. We never. What it means is that as much as we can now, try to reduce it. Start the shamatha practice. And when you do the shamatha practice, you'll find the shamatha practice will also help to do this. So yes, you're right. I mean, if you think, I'm never going to be able to do this, oh, I'm never going to be able to practice shamatha, that's not the what it means.
Because this can just do an aversion to thinking, you know, oh, I'm thinking again.
So again, that's what I've said, is that aversion or trying to block it or suppress it is like throwing petrol on the fire. That's not what it means to abandon. We cannot abandon something by having aversion to it, trying to push it away, trying to suppress it. That will definitely not work. So don't do that. Okay. We better break for lunch. We've run over time. So let's break for lunch now and come back at 2 o'clock.